Jordan found he had his sword in his hand, though he didn't remember drawing it. He couldn't for the life of him think what good it was going to be against something like Bloody Bones, but he clutched the hilt tightly anyway. The familiar weight of the sword was a comfort, if nothing else. The wind suddenly changed direction, bringing in the stench of blood and carrion that hung around the skeleton like a rotting shroud. Jordan's stomach heaved, and he backed away involuntarily. Behind him, the horses were ready to panic again. Jordan clenched his teeth together until his jaw ached, if only to keep from screaming. He wanted very badly to turn and run and keep on running until he found his way back into the safe and rational world again. But deep down, he knew that whatever he did, the creature would come and find him. He swallowed hard and stood his ground and realized for the first time that Roderick and Argent had joined him, swords at the ready. Gawain stood at his other side, holding his axe. His face was pale, but very calm. Jordan felt strangely lightheaded. The sight of Bloody Bones disturbed him deeply on some fundamental level. A skeleton couldn't move without muscles and tendons to move its bones, but Bloody Bones stood tall and awful above his violated grave like some horrid vision from a child's nightmare, held together by foul magics and his own undying hatred. The blind head turned slowly to stare at Jordan, and he somehow knew the skeleton could see him despite the empty eye sockets.
What happened? How did that thing escape from its burrow after so long?
Someone must have undone the warding spells. The same sorcerer who raised the thunderstorm.
You must be getting desperate. Raising Bloody Bones is one thing, but putting him back in the ground afterward, even the High Warlock might have some trouble doing that.
Yeah, that's as it may be. In the meantime, what the hell are we going to do? Can we fight it?
I don't think we've much choice. After all those years in the ground, he's probably very thirsty by now.
Of course. He drinks blood, doesn't he?
If he drinks blood, that makes him a vampire. I played one once. Can't we drive a stake through his heart?
He hasn't got a heart. And he's not a vampire. He's much more dangerous than that.
Scatter!
It was dumb luck that Jordan wasn't crushed under the creature's impossibly fast pounce. The others had already risen and resumed battle positions, but Jordan was paralyzed by shock. How quickly his whole life had changed. Jordan stood frozen where he was, unable to move, as Bloody Bones swayed toward him. The huge creature looked more dreamlike and nightmarish than ever. A massive bony hand reached down, the twig-like fingers flexing before his face. The two men fell sprawling to the ground.
Oh, thanks.
But Gawain was already gone. The runes on the blade were glowing with a scintillating white fire. Bloody Bones grinned down at Gawain, his fingers twitching eagerly. Drops of blood flicked from the bone fingertips in a steady stream. Gawain's axe whistled toward the nearest bony hand, but the skeleton drew it quickly back at the last moment. Gawain lurched forward, momentarily off balance, and Bloody Bones' right foot shot out. Gawain crashed backward into the heather and lay still.
No!
Roderick raised his hands above his head, and a wind began to blow. Sweat ran down his straining face as he used the last of his strength to fuel his magic. The wind hummed and whistled as it whipped through the skeleton's empty ribcage, but he stood his ground easily, unmoved. Argent crawled through the heather on his hands and knees, trying to sneak around and behind the skeleton while he was distracted. Jordan saw what he was doing and decided he'd better add to the distraction. He stood and palmed a flare pellet from his sleeve and nicked the wax coating with his fingernail. He threw the pellet into the heather between the skeleton's feet. Jordan covered his ears. He knew the thing couldn't scream. It didn't have any lungs. He felt a chill of horror run through him as he realized the flames weren't really hurting the skeleton. The blood on the bones blackened and smoked in the heat, but the bones themselves were untouched. Argent rose to his feet behind the skeleton, holding his sword awkwardly out before him. He braced himself, then cut savagely at the creature's spine. The skeleton lurched forward a step under the impact and looked back to see who had dared attack him. His body twisted all the way around so that his skull was facing Argent, in a move made possible only by his complete lack of flesh. Argent's sword was stuck fast. The bony hand lashed out and closed around Argent's throat. Bloody Bones picked him up and dangled him in midair before his grinning skull. The sword fell harmlessly from his spine. Argent clawed at the bony fingers, but couldn't budge them an inch. Blood ran down his neck as they slowly tightened their hold.
Robert!
Roderick saw a hairline fracture form on the monster's shin, but Bloody Bones refused to drop Argent. On the contrary, he lifted him higher and threw. Jordan winced at the sound.
No!
He realized suddenly that Gawain was back and at his side again. The knight favored his left ribs, and his face was beaded with sweat, but he was still clinging grimly to his axe. Roderick was darting back and forth before the skeleton, trying for a blow at the creature's spine, but unable to stand his ground long enough. Bloodybones' long-fingered hands swept through the air in vicious arcs, missing Roderick by less and less each time.
Smoke! I saw you use smoke in your act. Can you do it here?
Sure, but how's that going to help? If the fire doesn't bother him?
Just do it, and stand ready to help me. Arjun had the right idea, rest his soul. We've got to cut this bastard down to size. Wait till I've worked my way behind him, and then give me all the smoke you can.
Jordan nodded, and Gawain disappeared into the heather. Jordan tried to follow his movements, but quickly lost track of him. Gawain was good. He palmed one of the smoke pellets hidden in his right sleeve and hefted it uncertainly. He stared at the huge skeleton, and for a moment his breath caught in his throat. It was just so damn big! Blood dripped steadily from the discolored bones and soaked into the ground where the creature stood. The flames between its legs had already gone out. The skeleton's carrion stench was growing steadily stronger. Jordan glanced briefly at the horses, but knew there was no point in trying for one of them. They were all too spooked to be rideable. And besides, Bloody Bones would never let him reach them. Much as he wanted to run, Jordan knew he had no choice but to stand his ground and fight. And when all was said and done, he couldn't let Gawain down. He was hard-pressed to come up with one good reason why not, but somehow he just couldn't stomach the thought. Barely a day as a prince, and already he was acting like a hero. A hero? Maybe he was sickening for something. He watched Roderick sway back and forth before Bloody Bones. His movements were growing slower and more awkward as his tiredness caught up with him. The skeleton was just playing with him now, and they both knew it. Jordan decided he didn't wait any longer. If Gawain wasn't in place by now, he'd just have to take his chances. Roderick had already run out of luck.
Hey! You want to get a good look at the guy who's going to turn your ribcage into a house? Then look over here!
The skull turned towards Jordan, its eye sockets pouring blood onto the ground. He drew back his hand to throw the smoke bomb. His heart lurched as the skeleton headed straight for him with outstretched hands. Jordan took one look at the huge skull with its bloody grin and threw. A dark, oily smoke boiled up from the heather, quickly spreading to form an impenetrable, foul-smelling cloud. The skeleton swayed to a halt and batted at the smoke with its blood-dripping hands. Jordan decided that if the skeleton even looked like taking another step toward him, he was going to turn and run like crazy until his lungs gave out. And then, through the smoke, Jordan spotted a gleam of shining steel. Bloody Bones suddenly lurched to one side and fell helplessly forward. The ground shook as his great weight hit the earth. The pressure dispersed the remnants of smoke, and Jordan swallowed hard as he saw the skeleton had fallen so that its huge grinning skull was now only a few feet away from him. The skeleton already had his hands under him and was levering himself up out of the heather. Jordan started forward, sword held out before him, not sure what he was going to do, but determined to do something. The skeleton had made him afraid, and it seemed to Jordan that this had been happening to him too often just lately. He'd had a bellyful of being frightened, and just this once he was going to do something about it. Maybe he could whittle the bloody thing to pieces. And then the smoke cleared some more, and Jordan grinned fiercely as he saw the jagged stump that ended Bloody Bones' right leg just below the knee. Gawain loomed out of the smoke, brandishing his glowing axe.
Get the head! Hold it still while I go for the neck! And watch out for the teeth!
Get the head? All right!
Jordan grabbed the huge skull with both arms, hugging it to his chest. The grinning jaws snapped viciously, grating on his chainmail vest. Blood that was not his poured down Jordan's chest and stomach. The stench was almost overpowering. Jordan felt himself lifting up as the skeleton reared upward. His feet dangled below him as Bloody Bones lifted his head clear of the heather. But Jordan hung on tenaciously, and the great head began to sag under his weight. And then Gawain was there at his side, and the glowing axe swept down. Jordan lay on his back and watched dazedly as the headless skeleton took its next steps. He realized he was still holding the skull. It rolled to a halt and then rocked back and forth for a while, grinning at nothing. Jordan watched it until he was sure it was no longer bleeding. His chainmail was slick with the skeleton's blood, and he made a few half-hearted attempts to brush it away with his sleeves before giving it up as a bad job. He grinned stupidly at Gawain, feeling lightheaded and rather shaky about the legs. He was alive. He was alive! Gawain moved cautiously forward to stare down at the grinning skull.
Is it dead?
A final blow from Gawain's axe shattered the huge skull.
For now, it seems. That was well done, actor. For a moment there, I thought you might just turn and run.
Never crossed my mind. After you've faced Hillsdown audiences 7 days a week and twice on Saturdays, there isn't much in this world that can frighten you.
Roderick came over to join them, limping slightly, but otherwise apparently unharmed.
Are you badly hurt? That was a nasty blow you took.
Just a few cuts and bruises. I've been hurt worse in training sessions.
I'm fine, too, just in case you were worried.
I was never worried about you for a moment, Jordan. Actors always land on their feet. Did either of you see what happened to Robert?
There can't be much doubt. That creature must have thrown him a good 30 feet. Probably broke every bone in his body.
Not quite. It just feels that way.
They all looked around to see Argent making his way through the heather toward them. Roderick moved quickly to offer him a supporting arm, but Argent just smiled and waved it away.
Oh, I'm all right, Rod. I was lucky the heather broke my fall. I got the wind knocked out of me, and I'm carrying some bruises I'll be feeling for a while, but on the whole, I seem to have come out of it pretty much intact.
I should have known you were too devious to die that easily, old friend. You know, it's a pity we can't tell anyone about this. Destroying bloody bones would make us all heroes. Maybe even legends. They'd write ballads about us.
Jordan frowned. The thought had occurred to him.
Why can't we tell anyone?
Because officially, your highness has never left Castle Midnight, and neither have we.
Oh, yes. So, what are we going to do with the body?
Jordan refused to look away from the body. The heap of blood-spattered bones lay among the heather. It had stopped bleeding and looked utterly dead. Then again, it was a cursed skeleton.
We'll drop it back in the barrow and seal it up again as best we can. Only I think we'll take the pieces of skull with us until we find a nice deep river, and then we'll get rid of it there. Just to be on the safe side.
Never mind, lad. Maybe you could write it up as a play.
Oh, nobody would ever believe it.
When I'm on stage, people believe whatever I want them to. Isn't that why you chose me?
Prince Louis scowled at the silent scene before him. He couldn't tell what they were saying, but it was obvious they were congratulating themselves on their victory. Victor had done surprisingly well. All the intelligence reports on him suggested he'd grown harder and tougher during his years in exile, but even so. And that smoke had been a new trick. Victor must have been working on his magic, refining it.
I apologize for my failure, Your Highness.
I don't want apologies. I want results. And what the hell did you think you were doing? Raising bloody bones? If you hadn't been able to put him back in his grave, he'd have been a bigger menace to us than Victor ever could be.
It was a calculated risk. There was never any danger to us. I was in control of the situation.
Sure you were. That's why Bloody Bones is now nothing more than an old pile of calcified connective tissue. And our enemies are still on their way here.
Gawain's axe was an unknown factor. I can only deal with known factors.
All right. What else can you do to stop them from getting here?
Not a great deal, Your Highness. My magic has its limits. I'll need to rest a while before I can use my power again.
But they'll be here in a matter of days. And you saw how good they were. That bloody Gawain and his axe. And Victor and his fire magic.
You do have other allies, Your Highness. Allies you can call on when Prince Victor and his party arrive at Castle Midnight. There is, for example, Ironheart.
Louis looked at the tall suit of armor standing in one corner of his room.
Yes. There's always him.
Jordan got his first sight of Castle Midnight on the evening of the fifth day after leaving Bannerwick. His whole body ached after so long in the saddle, but even so, his first glimpse of the castle was enough to drive the pain right out of his mind. The great brooding shape of Brimstone Hill could be seen from miles away. The castle squatting at its top like a skull on a burial mound. Jordan studied it obsessively through the darkening twilight. Open fields lay stretched out around the hill, neat and even within their low stone boundary walls. The single straight road that led to the castle was wide, even, and well-maintained. All in all, everything seemed pleasant, ordinary, and civilized. And yet Jordan felt increasingly uneasy. It was the castle, of course, as out of place in the peaceful countryside as a toad in a rose garden. It stood stark and forbidding against the blood-streaked evening sky, and unhealthy lights burned in its narrow windows like so many watching eyes. Not for the first time, Jordan got the feeling that he was well out of his depth and sinking fast. He was an actor, not a double, and what little experience he'd had with court intrigues had left him with a steadfast determination to avoid them like the plague whenever humanly possible. He had little talent for treachery and double dealing, and trying to keep track of who was really working for whom gave him a headache. He wasn't even particularly happy about working as a double. Roderick and Argent had been very thorough in filling him in on the background details, and Gawain had grudgingly offered a few anecdotes that helped to reveal the prince's character. But when all was said and done, Jordan was an actor and used to a script, stage, and props. He could ad-lib when he had to, as could any actor worth his salt, but if truth be told, Jordan hadn't varied his act much in almost 4 years. He hadn't needed to. Now he had to take on a new character, in a strange setting, with no script and an audience who would probably have him executed if he didn't do an extremely convincing job. 50,000 ducats didn't seem nearly as much as it once had. Brimstone Hill drew steadily nearer as Count Roderick led his party along the deserted road. Both he and Argent had become grim and silent, and the suppressed tension in their body language hadn't done a thing for Jordan's nerves. He steered his horse in beside Sir Gawain's. The knight nodded to him absently, but said nothing, his gaze fixed on Castle Midnight.
Glad to be home again, Gawain.
The castle isn't my home, Your Highness. It's just a place where I happen to be living. But yes, I am glad to be back. We'll all be safer once we're inside the castle walls. Not that our enemies will give up on us, but their attacks will have to be more subtle and therefore less effective.
Speaking of my two brothers, just how are we going to get into the castle without being spotted by their agents? As far as everyone else is concerned, we're not supposed to have left the castle.
It's all been arranged, Your Highness. The head of castle security is one of us. A group of men who looked sufficiently like us from a distance set out for a little hunting party earlier today. They'll disappear into the countryside, and we take their place. Simple, but effective.
Wait a minute. How did they know we'd be here today? Any number of things could have happened to hold us up.
Count Roderick and the head of security have an understanding. Don't ask me to explain. It's to do with sorcery, and I've never had much interest in that.
Jordan decided to let that pass without comment.
Any last words of advice, Gawain? Once we've ridden through the main gates, I'm on.
You're doing fine, Your Highness. Just remember that you are a prince of the realm and act accordingly. Treat everyone like dirt, expect the best of everything, and look scandalized if you don't get it. When in doubt, be offensive and obnoxious. Everyone will expect you to be in a foul temper after an unsuccessful day's hunting, so they'll all make allowances. Lots of them.
I'm not playing a villain. I am not playing a villain.
I beg your pardon?
Nothing.
Jordan's stomach churned with first night nerves as the horses toiled steadily up Brimstone Hill toward the castle. He didn't even have the usual comfort of being able to lose himself in running through his lines. In the end, he fell back on his last resort and ran through a series of breathing exercises while concentrating very hard on the surrounding scenery. The hill itself looked surprisingly ordinary, being nothing more than a huge grass-covered mound. For a moment, it reminded him uncomfortably of Bloody Bones' barrow, but he refused to let his mind dwell on that. He looked up at the castle, and his mouth went dry. The stark black walls towered above him, bare and unadorned. Guards watched silently from the battlements, but no flags or pennants flew from the narrow towers. There was something subtly disquieting about the shape of the castle, a sense of wrongness in its angles and dimensions that grated on Jordan's nerves, made even more nightmarish by its very elusiveness. His horse tossed her head uneasily, and Jordan realized he was holding the reins so tightly that his hands were aching. He looked away from the castle and made himself concentrate on the breathing exercises. Slowly, he began to relax a little. He was the great Jordan, and this was just another acting engagement. He could do it. He just didn't want to. All too soon, the party reached the main gates. The horses waited impatiently as the huge iron portcullis inched into the air. Finally, it was up, and the party entered Castle Midnight. Roderick urged his horse forward. Jordan swallowed hard and followed him. The courtyard was brightly lit with flaring torches, and grooms and servants came hurrying forward to help the party dismount. Jordan started to swing down out of his saddle, and then quickly settled back again, as he saw the others hadn't moved yet. He waited patiently while the servants produced wooden blocks and placed them beside the four horses. Jordan raised a mental eyebrow as Gawain dismounted, then followed suit. A dismounting block. He'd fallen into the lap of luxury here. He stretched slowly, glad to be out of the saddle at last. He hadn't done so much riding in years, and now he knew why. He massaged his tired back with both hands and wished he felt unself-conscious enough to do the same to his aching thighs. He looked around him. His gaze fell on the dismounting block, and he frowned slightly. The other should have warned him about that. Ignorance of such everyday details was just the kind of thing that could show up an imposter. Of course, the others hadn't warned him simply because it was so much a part of their lives that they took it for granted. Jordan scowled unhappily. What else was there he hadn't been told about? The grooms took the horses away, and the servants closed in around the newcomers, proffering damp towels with which to clean the dust of travel from their faces and hands. Jordan used his gratefully, and when he was finished, he looked around for the servant who'd given it to him. The man had already vanished back into the bustling crowd of servants. Without hesitating, Jordan screwed the towel into a ball and tossed it over his shoulder without bothering to check if there was anybody there to catch it. He was a prince, after all. Princes don't care. They don't have to. He glanced unobtrusively around the courtyard, getting the feel of the place. There were far more torches and lanterns than he'd have thought necessary, but the courtyard was still a cheerless place, even with all the light. There were too many shadows, and the black stone gave the courtyard a brooding, claustrophobic atmosphere. "This isn't home," Gawain had said. "It's just a place where he happened to be living." A door opened to Jordan's right, and he looked around quickly as a middle-aged, plainly clad man entered the courtyard, flanked by two armed guards. Jordan's hand started to move toward his sword belt, and he stopped it with an effort. He couldn't afford to be seen looking worried. He held his head arrogantly high and waited for them to come to him. The new arrival was slightly below average height, with a solid, stocky frame and heavily muscled arms. At first glance, his face seemed open and even amiable, but the green eyes were wary and watchful and did nothing to mirror his professionally vague smile. His hair was a vivid red, brushed back from a sharp widow's peak, and Jordan realized with something like shock that this obviously hard, competent man dyed his hair. He made a mental note to remember that. It might be important to understanding the man.
"Welcome home, Your Highness. I trust you had an enjoyable day's hunting?"
"Bloody awful. Didn't see a damn thing worth chasing."
Jordan started to sweat. Who the hell was this man?
"How are things at court, Brian? Anything important happened since we left this morning?"
Not so far, my lord. Now, if your highness will permit, I would like to accompany you to your chambers. There are security matters I need to discuss with you in private."
Brian. Brian de Grange, head of castle security. He's in on the plot. Jordan nodded quickly to de Grange. He'd never been any good at recognizing people from a description.
"Of course. Will you accompany us, Roderick?"
"As you wish, sire."
"With your permission, I will leave you now, sire. I have business matters that must be attended to."
"And I've got work to do. With your permission, Highness."
Yes, yes, yes."
"Well, get a move on. I've got better things to do than stand around all day in a drafty courtyard."
De Grange bowed deeply and led the way into the castle interior. Jordan wondered if he'd imagined the glint of anger he'd seen in the man's eyes just before he bowed. The two guards fell in on either side of Jordan as he left the courtyard. He did his best to pretend they weren't there. He hated to admit it, but with Gawain gone, he felt decidedly more vulnerable. De Grange led him through a series of wide passageways and intersecting corridors, filled with bustling people who immediately stopped what they were doing to fall back and bow deeply as Jordan approached. At first, Jordan found this rather pleasant and not a little gratifying, but it soon became boring and finally irritating. The endless bowing was getting on his nerves. It was like walking through an endless supply of head waiters. He enjoyed the adulation he'd received as an actor because he'd felt he'd earned it by his art. But these people were bowing to him because they had to, not because they felt he was worthy of it. Jordan decided he didn't care for that at all. Receiving acclaim you hadn't earned was like drinking wine with no alcohol in it. It didn't thrill. Finally, he just ignored them all and didn't acknowledge anybody. He kept an eye out for ghosts and monsters and other traces of the unreal, but so far Castle Midnight seemed much like all the other castles he'd visited, dark, crowded, and drafty. The corridors became steadily narrower as they made their way deeper into the castle, and Jordan began to find the endless black stone walls both depressing and disturbing. It never seemed light enough, despite the many lamps and torches set in every conceivable niche. Echoes lingered on a fraction too long, and shadows caught at the corner of his eye with hints of unnatural shapes. He tried to tell himself it was all in his imagination, but he couldn't make himself believe it. He glanced surreptitiously at DeGrange, Roderick, and the guards to see if they shared his mood, but they seemed unaffected. Presumably, they were used to it. And then they came to a simple stone chamber, and the oppressive atmosphere was suddenly gone. Jordan stopped, dead in his tracks, and the others stopped with him. Jordan stood up a little straighter. He stretched and flexed his muscles. He hadn't realized what a weight he was carrying until it was gone. He felt calm and relaxed, and at peace with himself and the world. It was an unfamiliar feeling for him, and he just stood there for a while, savoring it. He looked about him curiously, studying the chamber. It was an unfamiliar feeling for him, and he just stood there for a while, savoring it. He looked about him curiously, studying the chamber. The walls were the same black stone as everywhere else, but here the color was flat and lifeless. Two torches burned in iron wall brackets, and their light filled the chamber with a warm, comfortable glow. A plain wooden crucifix hung on one wall, with a garland of fresh flowers beneath it. There was a row of simple wooden seats, but no other furniture or fittings.
What is this place?
This is a sanctuary, Your Highness.
Oh, of course. A sanctuary. Carry on, Brian.
He nodded to DeGrange, and they left the chamber behind them. The moment they passed through the doorway, the feeling of peace and restfulness was gone. Jordan said nothing, but decided he'd have quite a few questions to put to Roderick once they were safely out of the public eye. He didn't dare ask anything in front of the guards. Victor would have known what a sanctuary was. Finally, long after Jordan had lost all track of where he was in the castle, they came to a large, ornately carved and decorated door. DeGrange opened it, and then stepped back and gestured for Jordan to enter first. He did so, trying to put across with his upraised nose that he'd never expected anything else. The room before him was wonderfully spacious and luxuriously appointed. Thick carpets covered the floor, and brightly colored tapestries livened up the gleaming white walls. More than a dozen doors led off into adjoining rooms. Elegant and expensive furniture stood casually about, drawing attention to itself, though it seemed to have been assembled with little feeling or taste. Some of the pieces clashed so ostentatiously in style and period that Jordan felt like wincing. Having briefly been a nouveau riche during his more successful days, Jordan was a terrible snob where taste was concerned. He waited impatiently while the two guards busied themselves lighting candles under DeGrange's direction, and the moment they were finished, he gestured for them to leave with a quick jerk of his head. They did so, after bowing politely, and Jordan was finally left alone with Count Roderick and Brian DeGrange.
Phew, so far so good. What do you think of your quarters, Your Highness?
Very nice. Very opulent.
Yes. Victor's never been known for his taste. And if you think this is bad, where do you see the bedroom? Brian, dear fellow, allow me to introduce you to the great Jordan.
Jordan grinned at DeGrange and stuck out his hand. DeGrange put his hands on his hips and studied Jordan coolly.
You made a good choice, Roderick. The likeness is exact, even down to his voice and the way he walks. They'll have to work on the arrogance, of course, but that should come easily enough to an actor. Does he understand what his job here entails?
Yes, he's been thoroughly briefed.
I've no doubt he's word perfect on Victor's background, but does he understand what we all stand to lose if he fouls up?
I'm sure he does, Brian.
I wouldn't bet on it. I know his sort. He may style himself the Great Jordan, but deep down he's just like any other actor. Idle, shiftless, and unreliable.
If you don't stop talking about him as if he wasn't here, he is going to punch you right in the throat.
You forget your place, actor. You're a hired man, nothing more. We own you, body and soul. Out there in public, I may have to bow and scrape to you. But here in private, you'll call me sir and like it. Because if you don't, I'm going to hurt you. I know a lot about hurting people. I'm very good at it. Now get on your knees where you belong, actor, and call me sir.
Blow it out your ear.
DeGrange's hand dropped to the sword at his side, and Jordan's knee ascended into the man's groin. Blue-white flames leapt up around Jordan's clenched fist without consuming it. He leaned forward and stretched out his blazing hand toward DeGrange, who was sprawled on the carpet. The security man froze where he was. Beads of sweat formed on his face as Jordan stopped his hand only inches away from DeGrange's face.
You will treat me with respect at all times, both in public and in private. I can't afford to have you give the game away by reacting wrongly to me at any point. You're not a good enough actor to cover it up. Now get up and address me properly.
He didn't threaten the man. He didn't have to. His skin was tingling faintly, but as always, he'd taken no harm from the heat. The protection spell he'd bought all those years ago was still good. It ought to be. It had cost enough. DeGrange nodded briefly to Jordan and then looked at Roderick.
He'll do. When his hand burst into flames like that, I thought for one horrible moment that I'd got it wrong, and he really was Prince Victor.
As far as you're concerned, he is. And he's quite right. We have to be consistent in our attitudes toward him, or we're bound to make a mistake at some crucial moment. Now, apologize to him.
Apologize to him? That jumped-up actor?
He is your prince.
He locked eyes with DeGrange, and the security man's face went pale.
Do as you're told, Brian. Apologize to him.
I apologize for my disrespectful words and actions, Your Highness.
Then we'll say no more of it.
He cocked an eyebrow at Roderick.
Something happened there. You forced him to do that somehow.
Oh, yes, well, it wasn't difficult. DeGrange was once a widely respected and even more widely feared outlaw. He commanded one of the largest bands of cutthroats and bandits Red Hot has ever known. They were finally hunted down and tracked to their lair some 5 years ago. Most of them were slain, but Brian was taken alive. Rather than waste the man's obvious abilities, King Malcolm had Brian put under a geas, a controlling spell. And Brian is compelled to function as head of castle security, and to do a good job of it. Originally, he was answerable only to Malcolm. But with his death, that control has passed to me.
That was convenient.
No, I arranged it that way. A simple rider attached to the original spell. So small and insignificant you'd never know it was there unless you were looking for it. Malcolm never knew, of course, and Brian was prevented from volunteering the information. And you needn't worry about someone else taking control away from me. I changed the spell so that no more riders are possible. Malcolm never did know much about high magic and how it works. You can trust Brian implicitly, Jordan. He can no more betray us than he can grow wings and fly. Every now and again he tries to assert his independence, but all it takes is a few words from me to bring him back to heel. Isn't that right, Brian?
Yes, my lord.
Jordan scowled at them both. He'd heard about the Geas spell, but he'd never seen one in use before. Now that he had, he didn't like it at all. The Geas seemed like nothing more than a particularly nasty form of slavery. A man in chains can at least dream of escaping someday, but what hope has a man got when his mind and soul are in chains? He hoped the spell never broke down. If DeGrange ever got loose, he knew he'd make Roderick's death last a hell of a long time.
And now then, Brian, tell us what's been happening in our absence. How is Prince Victor?
There's been no real change in his condition. He's still weak and feverish, though he remains lucid, for the most part. Neither the surgeons nor the magicians can figure out what's wrong with him.
When do I get to see Prince Victor? I'm going to have to meet him, and soon, if this impersonation is to work. So far, all I've had are your descriptions of what you think he's like. I need to see the real thing for myself.
He'll be here any minute. Sir Gawain has gone to fetch him. Brian, what have Lewis and Dominic been up to?
Our spies have been keeping a close watch on them in public, but in private, they're both protected by strong magical shields, just as we are. Their people are still tearing the castle apart, searching for the missing crown and seal, but so far, they've had no more luck than our agents. Lewis has been spending a lot of time with the monk and Ironheart. Dominic and the Lady Elizabeth have been campaigning openly at court, trying to drum up support among the nobles.
Have they had much success?
Quite a bit. The court's never cared much for Lewis. Princes are supposed to have a taste for dueling, but he takes it too far. And he's always been too devious for his own good. These days, nobody trusts Lewis further than they can throw him, particularly since he became allied with the monk.
I keep hearing that name. He's a sorcerer, right?
We think so. It's probably best if you meet him for yourself and make up your own mind. The monk is a rather disturbing person. Carry on, Brian. How does the court feel about Victor?
Prince Victor lost most of his support when he was sent into internal exile, and since his illness, he's been unable to get out and rebuild his influence. There's been a lot of gossip about his absence from court of late, but nothing we can't handle. However, all this leaves Dominic in a very strong position. With the Lady Elizabeth's help, he's been building his power base practically unopposed.
Wait just a minute. According to Sir Gawain, Dominic is insane.
I wouldn't argue with that. But the current attitude at court seems to be that the Lady Elizabeth is sane and tough enough for the both of them. And while Dominic is a little strange on some subjects, his mind appears to be perfectly clear and lucid when it comes to political matters.
The main door swung suddenly open, and the three of them looked around sharply. Roderick took one look at the hooded figure in the doorway and got to his feet and bowed. DeGrange bowed too, and Jordan suddenly realized who the figure must be. The newcomer moved slowly forward into the room, supported on the one side by Sir Gawain and on the other by a beautiful young woman. The hooded man raised a shaking hand and pushed back his robe's cowl to reveal Prince Victor's face. Jordan stared at him. It was the same face he'd first seen in Roderick's mirror back in Bannerwyck. It had the same sardonic features, the same crooked nose, and the same jet-black hair. But this man wore the face differently. There was a weak petulance in the mouth and eyes, and deep frown lines clustered together between the scowling eyebrows. His skin was very pale and slick with a sheen of fresh sweat. The woman at his side helped him into the nearest chair, and Jordan seized the chance to study her. She was tall for a woman, about 5'9" or 5'10", with a tight, boyish figure that was still openly sensual. She couldn't have been more than 19 or 20 and was brimming over with life and energy. She had a long mane of light brown hair that fell almost to her belt, pulled back from a sharply etched, intelligent face. She was beautiful and graceful, but Jordan felt a sudden chill when she looked up suddenly and their eyes met. He saw ambition written clearly in her face, together with a ruthless determination. In that moment, Jordan knew her mind as though he'd known her for years, and in a way, he had. She had the look of every hard-edged leading lady he'd ever worked with, the kind of woman who always made sure no one else in the cast sang better than she did. When she broke the gaze and looked away, he felt almost relieved. There was an unwavering strength that burned in her like a bright flame, implicit in every move she made. Jordan didn't need to be told who she was. She had to be the Lady Heather Tawney, the latest love in Victor's life. Prince Victor finally got himself settled comfortably and looked hard at Jordan.
Come closer. Let me look at you. Oh, it's a strange thing to see your own face on another man's body.
Jordan moved forward obediently and stood before the prince's chair, letting Victor and Heather look him over. Their eyes weighed and measured him as impersonally as a butcher judging a side of beef.
Say something.
I am happy to meet you, Your Highness. I hope I meet with your approval.
He looks all right, but his voice is too high. I don't sound like that.
Hush, Victor dear. His voice is perfect. With some practice, I'm sure he'll sound just like you.
Victor shrugged, but said nothing more. Jordan looked to Roderick for a cue, but the Count avoided his eyes. Jordan looked back at the Prince. There was no doubt that the man's illness was eating away at him inside. He didn't look to have lost much weight, but his feebleness was apparent in every shaky movement. The Lady Heather patted Victor comfortingly on the arm and glared at Roderick and DeGrange.
It's been weeks since Victor first fell ill, and you still haven't found out what's causing it. How much longer is it going to take?
We're doing everything we can. Our magicians are adamant there's no trace of any sorceress attack. Not even anything as vague as a curse. The new quarters we've moved him to are a closely guarded secret and are warded against every kind of magic. He couldn't be any safer if he was in a sanctuary. In fact, right now, Prince Victor is probably the most securely guarded person in Castle Midnight, and that includes the regent. His food is prepared freshly every day under Robert Argent's supervision. Up until he left with Count Roderick, Argent even went so far as to taste the prince's food first in his presence. Since Argent is still well, I think we can rule out poison. I don't see what else security can do, my Lady Heather. As far as any of us can tell, Prince Victor has simply contracted a rather nasty illness, and that is the province of the castle's surgeons, not security.
The surgeons are doing everything they can, Heather. We all are. It's only a matter of time.
Gawain tells me we're no nearer finding the crown and the seal. Are you sure you've checked all the places I suggested?
Yes, Your Highness. There's still no sign of them. But then again, there's nothing to suggest your brothers are any closer to finding them either.
They've got to be here somewhere. I thought I knew all Dad's secret hiding places, but then anything I'd know, Louis and Dominic would know.
Wait a minute. I've just had an idea. Castle Midnight is lousy with ghosts, right? So why don't we just call up King Malcolm's ghost and ask him where he hid the crown and seal?
Everyone in the room looked at him with varying degrees of exasperation.
Don't you think we would have already done it, if it was at all possible? All members of the royal line are protected by spells from their birth, precisely to make sure that their rest won't be disturbed once they've died. There's nothing like everyday contact with ghosts to make you very determined never to become one.
Oh, this is ridiculous. Everything's getting out of hand, and I'm helpless to do anything about it. Oh, well, just means we'll have to work harder, that's all. Roderick, they tell me Dominic's been busy at court. He and his tame bitch Elizabeth. He's making too many friends. We can't allow that. You, actor.
Yes, Your Highness.
Do you think you're up to appearing as me in court?
I'm ready, Your Highness. What do you want me to do?
Sway some of those fools at court over to our side. Be calm and charming and persuasive. Promise them anything for now. Roderick, dig up all the dirt you can on Dominic and see that it reaches the right ears. If you can't find anything nasty enough, invent something. We haven't time to be fussy. Louis has magic on his side, with Ironheart and the monk. Dominic has Elizabeth's cunning, which is no less competent for all its deviousness, and both Louis and Dominic have a great many guards and men-at-arms under their command. I have one company of guards, a little sorcery, and damn all support at court. All of which means we have to work twice as hard and twice as dirty just to stay in the race.
He cocked a sardonic eye at Jordan.
You look surprised, actor. My body may be ill, but I assure you that my mind is still sound. Gawain.
Yes, sire.
Talk to the unattached guards and men-at-arms. Sound out how many might be willing to fight for us, and how many more might be swayed by promises of loot or patronage. When you've done that, start thinking of ways to get at my dear brothers. I've no doubt their protection is as good as mine, if not better. But there's always the chance they've left some small opening we can take advantage of. I won't feel secure until Louis and Dominic are dead and safely buried in their graves.
You'd kill your own brothers?
My God, you're actually shocked. Listen, fool, either Louis or Dominic is almost certainly responsible for the death of our father. He and I may have had our disagreements, but I was still fond of the old man, and I will avenge his murder. No matter what the cost. Besides, Dominic is barking mad and always has been, and Louis, I think I'd prefer it if he was mad. It might make some of his excesses easier to stomach. I've no love for my brothers, Actor. I knew them too well. The world will be a better place for their passing. And anyway, they stand between me and the throne. I've waited a long time for this chance, and I won't be stopped now. Not by anyone or anything. I will sit upon the throne of Redheart if I have to see all the corridors of this castle soaked in blood to do it!
Oh, shh, there, there. The surgeons told you not to exert yourself too much.
Victor finally got himself under control again and sank back in his chair, his eyes closed.
Roderick, Gawain, get me the crown and the seal. I've had enough excuses. I want results. Get them. I don't care how. Spend as much as you need to. Kill as many as you have to. Heather, I'm tired. Get me out of here. I'm tired.
Of course, darling. You can lean on Gawain and me, and we'll get you back to your new quarters.
Between them, she and Gawain got Victor to his feet again, and Heather pulled the cowl forward so that it hid his features. They left the room in silence.
So that's Prince Victor.
Yes. What did you think of him?
He's certainly determined. Is he really being poisoned?
No. The food comes from Argent's personal supplies. He's even tasted it himself, in Victor's presence. The prince is flinching at shadows.
And now, if you'll excuse us for a moment, Brian and I need to discuss Victor's instructions, so we'll leave you to settle into your new quarters. We won't be gone long, and the guards will stay outside your door to see that you're not disturbed. If you need anything, there's a bell pull by the fireplace. Someone will come when you call.
Fine by me. I think I'll do a little exploring. I've never seen a room with so many doors. If I'm not back in an hour, send a pack of hounds in to look for me.
Roderick smiled politely. De Grange just looked at Jordan. After a moment, they bowed formally and left.
What? They locked me in?
It was times like this that made him wish he'd taken up a career in carpentry, as his mother had wanted. Robert Argent sat alone in his study, leafing through the letters and business papers that had accumulated in his absence. He'd been doing it for some time, but he wasn't getting anywhere. He realized he'd just read the same paragraph for the third time, and it still hadn't sunk in. He dropped the letter onto his desk and rubbed tiredly at his eyes. He knew he ought to be concentrating. The letter was important, they all were, but none of it seemed to matter much anymore. The man who sweated his guts out over every deal, who squeezed each bargain till it screamed to get the last drop of credit, that was a different Robert Argent. That man lived only in the past now. Argent missed him. He sat back in his chair and looked around him. It was a medium-sized, simply appointed study. Modest, but comfortable. The carpet had been a gift from his late wife, and the portraits on the walls had been painted by his daughter-in-law. They were quite good, some of them. With the money he was making these days, he could easily afford living quarters that were much more ostentatious. But he'd never seen the point. He was a man of simple tastes, and always had been. It might have been different if he'd married again, but somehow he'd never got around to it. He could have married again. Among the merchant community, political marriages were even more popular than among the aristocracy. But he no longer believed in arranged marriages. He believed in love and romance, though there'd been precious little of either in his life. When he'd been younger, he'd pictured many possible futures for himself, but this hadn't been one of them. Argent smiled slightly, remembering his early days with Rod more than 20 years ago, when his friend had been plain Rod Crichton instead of Count Roderick. They'd had some times together, the two of them. One night in Hub City, they'd been thrown out of 14 inns in less than 3 hours, a record that still stood. Argent sighed and looked listlessly at the wine bottle on his desk, still unopened. He'd always liked his wine, but of late, he'd lost even that. When Rod had first come to him with his lunatic scheme of finding a double for the prince, it had seemed like old times all over again. The two of them together, against an uncaring world. And, of course, a chance to rebuild his fortunes after the failure of their last great scheme. But the deal had gone sour right from the beginning. Not his fault this time, or even Rod's. It had just turned out that the world had grown stronger and nastier than he remembered, while he had grown old and soft. Robert Argent stared unseeingly at the wall before him, a man with too much past and no future at all. Jordan wandered around the huge room, looking for somewhere to settle. The room seemed uncomfortably large and echoing now that he'd been left alone in it. He trailed his fingertips across the furniture, trying to get the feel of the place. Something about the furnishings and fittings just didn't add up. The look of the room was a total mess, a hopeless mixture of styles. It was as though every item had been chosen to impress the viewer with its appearance and value, but without caring about the overall picture they presented. The room was more like a showroom than a place where somebody actually lived. Jordan shrugged. Maybe that was how Victor saw it. Jordan crossed over to the nearest window and pulled back one of the drapes to look out. Night had fallen, and the stars were out. The night looked cold and forbidding, and Jordan shuddered briefly. So far, Castle Midnight was proving as gloomy and uncomfortable as he'd thought it would. He hadn't come across an architect yet who could design a castle that was fit to live in. All in all, Jordan was beginning to feel thoroughly depressed. He hadn't seen a single happy face or cheerful sight since he'd entered this great hulking pile of black stone.
Hmm? Probably just the bloody castle settling.
He spotted a drinks cabinet set against the opposite wall and moved determinedly toward it. He felt very strongly that after the day he'd had, he was owed a drink or two. Or several.
Hmm.
He stared at the row of cut glass decanters before him. They had all been fashioned into the shapes of strange, fantastical creatures, such as unicorns, wyverns, or cockatrices. The shapes of the bottles were grotesque and distorted, and more importantly, there were no labels to describe the contents. Jordan smiled briefly. Of course there weren't any labels. Victor would know what his own decanters held. And the shapes might be a bit queer, but then Victor's taste in furniture wasn't that impressive either. Jordan picked up the nearest decanter and hefted it in his hand. The cut glass was a solid weight and hideously expensive. He let his mind play idly with a few schemes for making off with the decanters as a sort of insurance in case things went wrong later, and then reluctantly discarded the notion. He stood to make 50,000 ducats out of this impersonation, and he wasn't about to risk that for a few cut-glass decanters. The dark purple wine inside smelled strong and acidic, not to mention malevolent.
Plum brandy. Had that once. Hangover lasted 4 days. No thanks. Malt whiskey. Smells like we have a winner. Now, where are the glasses? Who's there?
The room lay open and apparently harmless before him. All the doors were still shut, and no one could have got past the guards outside without his hearing. Jordan remembered some of the things Gawain had told him about ghosts and monsters, the real and the unreal, and a slow chill ran through him. He checked the distance between him and the main door, swallowed hard, and wondered if the guards would hear him if he screamed for help. He did his best to get hold of himself. He angrily reminded himself that so far he hadn't seen anything that looked even remotely threatening, and he'd look like a twit if he summoned the guards and then had to admit it was only his imagination. He realized he was still holding the decanter in his left hand. He looked cautiously around him. The room was very quiet. Jordan moved slowly forward, holding his sword out before him. The nearest door lay to his right. If he remembered Roderick's gesture correctly, that was the bedchamber. What better place for an assassin to be hiding? Jordan padded quietly over to the door and pressed his ear against the wood.
I knew it.
He took a firm hold on the doorknob with his left hand and turned it slowly. The door eased open just an inch. He let go of the doorknob very carefully and wiped his sweaty palm on his clothes. He couldn't see anything on the other side of the door now. He felt a sweat break out, and his legs were just a little shaky. He began to wonder if the assassin was standing on the other side of the door, listening to him, waiting for him to make the wrong move. Jordan decided he wasn't going to think about that. He also decided he'd better do something fast before what little was left of his nerve disappeared completely. A large dog by the bed looked up, startled by Jordan's sudden entrance. It started to back away, then stopped and wagged its tail hopefully. Jordan looked quickly around the room, but there was no one else there.
All this fuss over a pet dog. I am really getting paranoid. Come here, boy. Come on.
The dog bounded forward to greet him, its tail wagging furiously. Jordan sat on the edge of the bed and petted the dog happily. It pushed against his legs and showed every sign of intending to stay there for some time.
Good boy, you're a good boy.
The dog looked up at him, grinning in agreement. It was a good-looking dog, obviously pedigree, and apparently quite happy, though it was rather hard to tell with a bloodhound. The face wasn't really equipped to register happiness, and it had the saddest eyes Jordan had ever seen. The dog was obviously well-trained as well as friendly, in that it hadn't tried to jump up on him the moment it met him, and Jordan's estimate of Victor went up a little. Anyone who kept a fine animal like this as a pet couldn't be all bad. He just wished someone had mentioned it was there. He grinned down at the bloodhound, and it put its head into his lap for him to scratch behind his ears. Jordan lay back and looked about him, taking in his bedchamber. He hadn't seen anything this luxurious since he'd sung for his supper in a top-rank brothel in Hub City. There was no denying it was comfortable, very comfortable. But it was also gauche, gaudy, and almost terminally sensuous. His boots practically disappeared into the thick piled carpet, and the bed was so soft it was like sitting on a cloud. In fact, he'd sunk so deeply into it, he wasn't sure if he could get up again without help. As usual, the fittings and furnishings clashed loudly, but Jordan was growing inured to that. His gaze fell on the huge, blocky wardrobe that covered most of one wall, and a thought occurred to him. Sooner or later, he was going to be meeting the important people at court, and when he did, he'd better not be wearing his present attire. After several days on the road, his clothes smelled strongly of sweat, dust, and a few other things he didn't even want to think about. He was surprised flowers hadn't wilted in their vases when he had walked past them. Presumably, there was a bathroom somewhere in this suite, and he'd look for it later, when he had the time, and when he was fairly sure he wouldn't be interrupted. Roderick or the others could be back at any time, and he hated being interrupted in the bath. Right now, he'd settle for a change of clothes.
All right, time to get up. Ooh.
Jordan pushed the dog gently to one side and struggled up off the bed. The wardrobe's doors slid smoothly back on their runners, and Jordan stared in amazement at more clothes than he'd ever seen in one place in his life. He'd worked in theaters that had smaller wardrobe stocks than this. There were robes and outfits for every conceivable occasion, and a few so outrageous they had to be either strictly traditional or left over from some best-forgotten masquerade. Jordan stripped off his travel-stained clothes and tossed them casually in the direction of the bed. He kept his shirt, even though it was no longer really a good fit for his new body. He'd have to adapt some of Victor's shirts when he had the chance. But for now, the hidden pockets in the sleeves, with their flare pellets and smoke bombs, were an advantage he didn't intend to give up. He chose an outfit pretty much at random and dressed quickly. The clothes felt almost sinfully comfortable and fitted perfectly. Jordan struck a pose in front of the wardrobe's full-length mirror. It had been a long time since he could afford clothes like these. The rich scarlet color really suited him, particularly when set off by the billowing burgundy cloak.
Your Highness! Where are you?
I'm in here. What's going on?
Jordan hurried out into the main room and found Roderick and Gawain waiting for him. His heart sank as he took in their worried expressions.
What is it? What's happened? The regent has summoned all three princes to attend a special audience at court. The last time he did that, it was to inform them of their father's sudden death. I hate to think what he might have to say this time. Does he know about us?
About me?
I don't see how. But that doesn't mean much where the regent's concerned. The man has an uncanny knack for discovering things that everyone else had thought was safely hidden. It wouldn't matter so much if he wasn't so damned honest. Beats me how he survived at court all these years.
Jordan thought furiously about all he'd been told so far. If he remembered his briefing correctly, with the king's death it was traditional for a regent, chosen in advance by the king, to rule over the day-to-day problems of the kingdom until a new king was declared. The regent at this time was one Count William Howard, first cousin to King Malcolm. A fair man, but a hard man, had been Roderick's summing up. And too honest for everyone's good, Gawain had added.
How soon does he want to see me? And where's De Grange and Argent? Shouldn't they be in on this?
De Grange is busy checking into whether there really is a traitor among our people. He'll join us when he can.
I've sent word to Robert, but we can't wait for him. The regent wants to see you immediately. Lewis and Dominic are probably already on their way to court by now. We must leave at once, Your Highness. It would look very bad if you were to arrive late.
All right, then.
Lead the way.
Jordan let them usher him out of the main door and into the corridor. The two guards followed along as an honor escort. It was only then that Jordan remembered he'd left the dog behind in the bedroom. He knew he couldn't have brought it with him into court, but all the same, hopefully he wouldn't come back to a little present on his bed.
Sir Gawain, what do you think of the new clothes? Is it a suitable outfit for meeting the regent?
It'll do. You've worn worse in the past.
Oh, you're a great help. Look, what if the regent really has found out about us? What can we do?
I don't know about you, but if things do turn nasty, I personally will head for the nearest window, crash right through it without pausing, and keep on running until I reach a different country. Somehow I don't think the regent will see the funny side of all this.
Terrific.
He thought hard as they hurried down yet another corridor. Of all the confusing details in his new role, the missing will interested him the most. Whoever took it must have either wanted to know who the king had named as his successor, or believed the will held a clue as to the whereabouts of the crown and the seal. But it seemed clear that neither Lewis nor Dominic had the crown and seal. If they had, they'd have made themselves king by now. Jordan didn't like the way his thoughts were heading. If the princes didn't have the will, then who did? Could there be some other separate party at work?